Kurt Gorman from Phase Tech. Kurt is a second-generation phaser builder. He grew up learning the business with his father's company, CSP Inc., back in the late 70s and early 80s. He attended Penn State University for electrical engineering. In the mid-80s, he served as director of engineering for Vector Technology, the successor to CSP. In 1990, he formed Phase Tech with his father. He is responsible for all of the company's operations and performs the RF circuit design for phasing systems, antenna tuning units, and multiplexing systems. He has designed, installed, and adjusted numerous single frequency and multi-frequency systems. Here to present optimizing combined AM antenna systems, Kurt Gorman. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As many of you are probably aware, with the state of the AM broadcast industry these days, that we find many stations there where the property, in many cases, is worth much more than the radio station. Or the stations have been stuck in a lease for so many years where they're paying such a large amount of money that they can't... Can you hear me? Okay. That they can't actually afford that to pay that lease every month. So the biggest thing that we've seen in the AM industry, I think, in the past couple of years is people basically trying to co-locate as many stations as they can on one tower site. So, and each of those cases is different there because, I mean, you could do one station on one tower, you could do two stations on one tower, but we have many cases where we have two or three stations that are on three or four towers. And that's where things get to be a little bit challenging. Just to give you an idea here, some of the stuff that goes into planning there is looking at not only what can be done from the station, but also looking at the physical site of where somebody's talking to move to, because that makes a big difference as far as if we have a station on a low frequency that wants to move to a station that has real short towers, it gets to be impractical. So I think one of the biggest things as far as initial planning goes is not only from an FCC standpoint as far as making sure the allocation would work there for that proposed station, but also making sure that what is existing at that site is something that's suitable that could be made to work with the proposed station coming over there. And that's where sometimes it's hard for the engineering and the management to get on the same page, because the management may not understand that if we have a 200-foot tower there, it may not be very good at 600 kilohertz there of why we can't move to that site. So a lot of times that's where the engineer has to kind of walk the management through and tell them, you know, we need certain things to electrically make it work before you go negotiate a lease that we're actually going to move there. But some of the, typically when we build and design the diplexing equipment, typically we'll use a conventional type of filtering circuits there where we can place those at various points in there in the circuitry or add to the existing circuitry of an existing station that basically give us a high impedance at the reject frequency and a low impedance at the pass frequency. And there's many different applications for these filters, and as I'll explain in a little bit there, by choosing where we put some of that filtering, we can also improve the condition of some of these existing stations there. Because frankly, many of the existing stations that we put equipment in, nothing's been done to the transmitter site for many, many years. It could be 20, 30 or more years. So when we go to design the diplexing stuff to add the next station, it's always a good idea, and that actually by default gives us the opportunity to try to improve and clean up some of the stuff that's been neglected for years, or just redesign it something that's a little more state of the art there instead of something that maybe was just kind of manually forced years ago and made to work, where now we can do a little more of that on the computer and design that such that we can actually improve what's there now at the same time. But typically, these are the filter circuits, and typically we'll put those at a high impedance point there. But as I'll show in a minute, we can put those at different locations depending upon the application. Now, typically, with the diplexing of multiple tower systems and even close systems there where we have two close frequencies on a single tower, I always find that it's better not to try to brute force everything with just a single set of filters at the output of, say, the matching network and then just try to force it there. It's actually better to try to do a little bit of filtering there and a little bit of filtering at the transmitter side of things so you're not in deterring that bandwidth, and also you can get better rejection that way. This here is a typical diplex case. This is a typical diplex case here where we have basically a matching network for each of the frequencies, and we have a filter there. In this case, you can see on the output, there's basically a common component there that's basically, that would be common to both frequencies. And that's probably one of the most important things in the diplexing, no matter if it's a non-directional or if it's a directional, is basically to look at the impedance at basically what I would refer to as the mix point where both frequencies are tied together, and try to optimize that impedance there for both frequencies. In a perfect world, we would have a fairly reasonable resistance, maybe in the 40 to 100 ohm range, and very low reactance at that point. This way, not only from a bandwidth standpoint, because we would be putting a shunt filter from the other one basically in parallel with it, but also from a voltage standpoint, if we lower that reactance where the two frequencies join, it lowers the voltage considerably, which helps us with our filtering as far as any unwanted voltage coming back. Now, typically what I will do is, if you see here, there's a, we have the, and I'll try to find that pointer. I'm not sure you get this pointer here. I don't know if you can still hear me or not. But typically, this is basically just a series filter right here for each of the frequencies. This is a common component that I was referring to here that basically tends to either change the reactance, or some cases will actually use a shunt element there and actually change the resistance and the reactance for both frequencies. Here, on this case here, we basically have a shunt filter that basically is basically a short circuit at the unwanted frequency and a high impedance at the frequency that's passing through here. That basically, it provides a low impedance to ground for this filter and clamps any of that voltage that's coming back. And also, at the same time, we can use that circuit and kind of tailor the characteristics of that circuit so that it actually helps the impedance at, say, plus or minus 10 kilohertz. Now, in this case here, where depending upon how the tower impedances are, I have put that shunt filter on the antenna side of the input T matching network, which is matching that basically back to the 50 ohm line to the transmitter. Now, in this next case here, what we have done is we have taken that same thing And that's basically, I have moved that over, and you can see that that's on the transmitter side of the T-matching network, that shunt filter in this case. And in this case here, we have just a capacitor here instead of in the other case where we had an inductor, because depending upon what the reactances of the antenna are at the various frequencies, really determines what we need to do to what I would refer to as sloping or modifying that impedance there for each of the frequencies. So by putting this here in this case, the actual input bandwidth was better than putting it on the other side, which would be right over on this side, which we had in the previous case. So basically, I guess, getting back to the initial thought, there's really no conventional block diagram as far as how and where each of the filters should be. What really needs to be done is, once it's determined where it's going to go and what the tower impedances are, at that point, it really needs to be looked at and see where is really the best location for those filters to give you not only the rejection that you need, but also to give you the best possible bandwidth at the same time. Now, going back, summarizing a few of those things there, not only can we put the filters on the input side, but the series filter that I mentioned too, typically we can put those additionally at, say, if it's a directional, we'll put an additional filter right up at the phasor common point there so that we have something there to clamp any unwanted voltages. A lot of times you could either use a shunt circuit there, or you could just take and use a series circuit there. Depending upon what the sideband reactances are, you can actually use the filter not only to get rid of the unwanted voltage, but also to help the sideband reactances and help the sideband VSWRs. So that's a thing that we've been doing a lot of, is taking an existing system and also and putting that stuff in there so that we at the same time get the rejection we need, but also we either don't disrupt or we can actually improve some of the bandwidth that's there. Now, I have a few years back I developed a circuit there that's basically what I refer to as a PI filter circuit there, which is basically configured as a conventional PI network that would match 50 ohms to 50 ohms. And each of these legs here are configured so that they're basically a short circuit at the reject frequency. And if it's a 90-degree PI network, it would be plus or minus J50 ohms at the pass frequency. And then this network, this would be the 50 ohms of the opposite sign to whatever the two shunts become at the pass frequency. But using this technique and putting that at the 50 ohm point there, we've been able to do frequencies that have been very close together, where we can get 20 or 30 dB of rejection and still have very decent bandwidth. So in many cases, unfortunately, this is something that really needs to be put at a 50-ohm point there. So in cases where we've had people that wanted to diplex and they have very close frequencies, many times what can be done is use the conventional filter, as I showed before, that would be at the tower end of it, and then use a filter like this right at the transmitter end and not try to force all of that there. This way you can actually make something work that has, you know, 70 or 80 kilohertz of frequency separation and still have reasonable numbers. I mean, there's always going to be some drawback as you get tighter and tighter with the frequencies. There's only so much you can do. But by breaking it up in pieces that way, you can at least get things that are closer to have reasonable numbers there. But this Pi filter circuit works very nicely, and in reality, the Pi filter circuit, and we've done also similar things with using a T network there and trying to configure that shunt leg, but the Pi circuit tends to have much better performance there because you end up with two of those shunts to ground there, and it does tend to act somewhat as a low-pass filter. This is the actual typical construction of that there, where typically this will have a variable capacitor and a fixed inductor. So typically when we set them, we typically set them with the network analyzer, as I mentioned earlier, where you can basically set that for 50 ohms at the pass frequency and basically a short circuit at the reject frequency, which is kind of nice because even if you went to a station and you really didn't know what was downstream there as far as it was an old system there and you looked at it and you were almost afraid to touch anything that was there, you could at least go to the transmitter, assuming that it's a 50-ohm input up there, and you could at least put this there and really not have to go back and reinvent the wheel and at least get rid of if you had somebody nearby or what have you that was getting into that transmitter. And that's been typically the case, too, with multiple stations that have been around the corner from each other with the solid-state transmitters. We've designed and provided a lot of these filters where people will just take and put them right on the output of the transmitter port since it's matching 50 ohms to 50 ohms. The other thing that we sometimes do with that is, depending upon if it's a non-D or a DA, and if we can use the phase shift of the Pi circuit there, we could actually take and rotate those impedances there, so we can kind of use that filter to serve two purposes, where it basically serves the purpose of rejecting the stuff and also giving you some impedance rotation at the sidebands at the same time there. But that is usually the most of the challenge with the diplexing is, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's usually somebody moving from a site to an existing site, and most times you just really don't know what you have at those existing sites there. And that gets to be the most challenging. I mean, if you were starting from scratch and putting two new ones on, then it wouldn't be as bad, but 9 times out of 10, you're taking and having to go through and actually fix something, but it does give the opportunity at that point to clean up some of that stuff at the same time. This is some filtering that we did. We measured some filtering that we did down in Chicago not too long ago there, where we have stuff down there at 50 kilowatts there for WSCR and WBBM, and also WGN is right in the middle there. So we have 670, 720, and 780, all at 50 kilowatts, right near each other down there. So on both BBM and WSCR, we have the Pi filter circuitry in there, which on the 50 ohm there at the 50 kilowatts, and that does a very nice job to reject that stuff. And we still have very good sideband impedances, even though we have 20 or 30 dB of rejection. We still have VSWRs even at 15 kilohertz, plus or minus 15 kilohertz, that are in the 1.4 range or less, because all of those stations are running the HD on them there. And at the same time, since those are non-D, we ended up using the Pi filter that's there to rotate the impedance so that the transmitters have the proper rotation at the output port. So that technique there. But this is typically what one of those will measure. And you can see on this next graph here, that shows you there typically what that even with fairly close frequencies there, we're able to achieve very, very decent notch there as far as attenuation goes on that filter circuit. Trying to do close frequencies like that with the original filters that I showed, with basically just a series coil and a capacitor and then parallel resonating it, that can be done if you have, you know, with 200 or 300 kilohertz of frequency separation. It's not as challenging to get that, but when you're in the 100 kilohertz range of frequency separation, it is very difficult, you know, you can either get the rejection or the bandwidth. It's hard to get both with just a conventional type filter circuit. So that's why the Pi filter circuit actually is much better, and in reality it's much better doing that stuff where you can put those at 50 ohm points in the circuit there. Also, we've used some of that circuitry there too, where we can actually use that Pi circuit. You could actually use that Pi circuit there and use that for multiple frequencies there. So basically, and that's the case too, where typically, especially when we're triplexing there, you know, we're not only talking about one frequency, we're talking about two frequencies, maybe even more, because it may actually be that we have two frequencies on the site that we got to get rid of, but we got another two frequencies that are a quarter mile down the road that we have to at least have some attenuation on. So by using various types of those filters there and putting them at different locations is really the key to making any kind of combined antenna system work there. But one of the biggest factors, as I mentioned before, going back to that, is actually where you put those filters in the circuit. I mean, you can just haphazardly place filters like we had on this other one here. I mean, you could just make these couple filters a fairly high Q filter and just leave the existing matching network the way it was if it was already there, if you were just adding one. But typically that's what I really refer to as the brute force method. Yes, it would work, but you'd probably be sacrificing something, typically the bandwidth there, trying to make it work that way. So that's why, even though this one and the one before are basically doing the same thing, by different location of that can make a big difference in how the performance of the whole system works there. And then typically what we'll do is make that such that it's a low frequency, and then this would be the feed lines going back to the transmitters. And in that case, if we needed rotation or if we wanted a little more rotation, that's where I've put the Pi filter there, or actually put that Pi filter, the 50 ohm filter, right at this point, basically before the feed line there. So there's two different locations where we could put that 50 ohm filter, either at the matching network or ATU side of the transmission line, or we could put it right up at the output port of the transmitter. I find it better to put up at the output port of the transmitter, because typically if you have any stray voltages or anything like that coming back, you could clamp them out, and that's probably the most important spot where we don't want the voltages, is getting back into the output port of the transmitter. So that's why typically, even if it's, you know, if the frequencies are far enough apart and there's good shielding and the powers are low, then it doesn't become a problem. But some of the cases we're dealing with 50 kilowatt systems. I mean, we put in a couple of years ago down in D.C. down there, we have four tower array there where we have 250 kilowatt AMs on there and a 10 kilowatt AM that are all operating on the four towers all the time. Unfortunately, at the low frequency, the towers are fairly short, so you have a lot of current there. Then as you get to the higher frequencies, the towers become taller and you have a lot of voltage there. So it's always a compromise there as far as what you can do. But in that particular case there, not only did we put filtering out at each of the towers, But on all three stations there where we have the input there, we put filtering circuits right on the input so that any stray stuff that was coming back, we could just get rid of that and clamp that to ground. So that would probably be one of the most important aspects of the whole thing, is determining from the impedances and what kind of voltages you have, is just seeing where the filtering really needs to go. But like I said, just, you know, using a 50-ohm filter of some sorts there, if you can break down and just do a little bit of that filtering at the tower and try to clamp the rest of it as need be, if you still have enough voltage that you need to get rid of, is a much better case scenario. Any questions on? Yeah. We have cascaded filters there, and what I'll try to do is, especially like in a triplex case there, we'll basically have a set of filters for one frequency and then a set for the other, and then we'll try to use some multi-stage filter at the input. So a lot of times we'll split up where we put the cascaded filters there, because typically we can get, if it's a couple of different frequencies, we'll try to clamp the one that's the closest frequency first, and then the one that's got the greater frequency separation is spread that out a little bit there. Yes.
Hi, Kurt. Steve Kanopka here. How you been?
Good.
I was wondering whether any of your trials and successes on that involved trying to use a common transmission line, or isn't that a good idea?
Well, we've tried to use a common transmission line on like a two-frequency situation, and the problem with that there is we could get rid of the stuff at the transmitter side of that 50-ohm line, but the problem is was trying to have some sort of a reasonable impedance at both frequencies on the load side of that line was usually very difficult to achieve. So the only time that we've had success with that, frankly, is when the only good thing about when people diplex real close frequencies is typically the antenna impedance is very similar. So when you have real similar antenna impedances, you can almost get a similar match to that line there. So, and then you could basically isolate that once it gets up to the transmitters. But most times the impedances are dramatic enough that we can't match it individually on the lines there. So any other questions?
My question has to do with something a little extraneous to your filtering systems. Have you ever run into a situation where you had two stations on disparate frequencies and the ground system length has come into play as a source of a problem with which you've had to deal, and if you had to call for a modification of the ground system, the length of the radials at any point to ameliorate the problem?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's a very, very good point when looking at the sites there, because the site that we put it in DC, that was originally constructed for 1580 kilohertz. We added 1390 kilohertz and 1120 kilohertz there. At 1120 kilohertz, not only were the towers short, but also the ground system. And the efficiency was, in some of the areas, there wasn't even a full ground system to begin with. And in that particular case, the efficiency ended up, and the impedances were such that we ended up going back and increasing and filling in a bunch of that ground system there. We couldn't quite, there was not enough property to get it where it was ideal for the lowest frequency, but we kind of split the difference and got as much as we could there. And but that's a very good point. And a lot of people, they look at the tower, but don't think about the ground system on the AM. And that is a very important aspect. And I've seen where people have signed a deal to move over to a station without even thinking about it, and then they get in and they're locked into that and realize that the thing's not going to really perform correctly without doing something to adding to that ground system, And in many cases, the land is such where they can't add to the ground system, and that becomes a real problem, whether there's a parking lot or obstructions or the boundaries are so close. And then it's one of those things. The only thing that, you know, with the FCC guidelines there as far as lowering some of the minimum efficiency standards, that probably would help some of that from a technical aspect. But from a coverage aspect there, I've had a lot of management say, you know, why, you know, we really should have more coverage there, but it's hard to explain to them that really the tower that they're operating on was really not designed for the frequency that they're running. But that's a very good point that many people do not come up with and think about there, yeah. Any other questions? Getting back to, I mean, the triplexing is one of those things that, right now you would like to think that in the AM business that people are actually replacing their equipment just to replace their equipment, but it seems like I would say most of the motivation is because of combining these sites. And I think down the road, we're going to see more stations that are going to be two and three frequencies there. There's quite a handful of them out there that are two, and there's some that are three, but I think that's going to be probably more the common down there, and it just makes it much more difficult for the engineers to take care of, assuming that they have either one engineer or a couple engineers that get along there, because there's just so many different pieces to the puzzle there. It's not like if something fails and his transmitter's off, it's not necessarily something in his phaser tuning unit that failed. It may be a capacitor in the filter for one of the other guys. So it just makes troubleshooting that a little more difficult, because instead of having one or two networks out there, you might have 16 or 20 networks spread out at the four towers there. So, but that's why it's important that, you know, when the filters are put in, that things are put in so that people can actually see what's there. And, you know, they're kind of, normally when we build the equipment, I always find a good rule of thumb is to take and, you know, we always sectionalize any of the cabinetry where that, so we basically have the filtering would be in one section and the matching in another. So at least that gives you, not only from a shielding standpoint, but it breaks some of that stuff up too. So if you do have a problem, you can kind of go down the chain there and try to look and see if something has failed or not. Yeah.
Metrics economically about what's going on
sure.
with the AMs. Kurt and I have done a couple of projects together, and he's involved in one right now in California that sits on, I don't know, the three tower array was probably on what, 25 acres?
Yeah.
Roughly. It is in the South Bay area. And everybody in this room probably understands that real estate's not cheap in the Bay Area. It was recited to me by the consulting engineer on the project that this was the largest privately owned contiguous piece of property, you know, not counting state parks or whatever, but privately owned piece of property that was contiguous left in the South Bay Area around San Jose. I don't know what that's worth, but it's probably worth a whole handful of millions of dollars, maybe two or three handfuls of millions mm-hmm. of dollars. So the economics are pushing this. And, you know, what starts in California eventually works its way to the center of the country. There's a project like this going on in Kansas City right now, where legacy tower sites in the middle of a very nice neighborhood right outside of Kansas City, and the neighborhood people for the past 25 years have wanted the tower site out. Very valuable piece of land. And Kurt and I had just finished a project over in Tennessee. It was in a smaller town, but the University of Tennessee owned all the land around the 3.5 acres that the station sat on, and that forced the diplex from site A over to his other AM at site B. Luckily, we were going from the high-frequency site to the low-frequency site. But, again, a very big number attached to the value of that 3.5 acres. So I think it's just a matter of time to guys in this room that are involved with AMs might see the same thing happen.
I think you're going to see a lot of that coming up there with the way the economy is and the way it is for the AM stations there, especially when a lot of them, like Chris said, I mean, some of these properties are huge there where these old AMs were built, and they're worth a fortune now. And unfortunately worth much more than the radio station in most cases there, but I think that's what most of the engineers are going to see. And I think really it should not scare the engineers as long as they have a feel for what we're trying to accomplish and what the various pieces are. I think as long as, you know, you look at some of the triplexing and diplexing systems and it can look overwhelming, but I always find it best there is just to take and break it in pieces and say, I got this matching network here, I'm filtering here, I'm sloping the impedance there. And if you break it up into little pieces, it's not only easier to handle from a troubleshooting standpoint, but this way from a maintenance and if something changes standpoint there. So even with the design, when we design the stuff, we break it into pieces. Then when we build it, we break it into pieces. And probably when the engineer takes care of it, he should break it into pieces there, because that's really what the whole, any combined system is, just accumulating a number of pieces. Unfortunately, they're all tied together such that without one piece, the system may or may not work, but you need all those pieces there. So, any other questions? Yes, Steve.
Sitting here listening to this, and I'm not an AM person, but it occurred to me that there's a radiation efficiency requirement to assist the FCC in assigning frequencies to specific station licenses and doing the required calculations to avoid interference. And with the run-up in the price of real estate and the tendency of people to spread out away from the urban core, has anyone considered an alternate architecture in which, instead of having a single transmitter, one has distributed AM transmitters without any particular radiation efficiency requirement, frequency locked together to cover an urban area with a series of lower power transmitters on the same assigned channel?
Well, that's a good point. And I know that there's been some stuff that's been done over the years as far as using some of that to fill in areas with lower power stuff there. And, I mean, even in a couple areas, we have, you know, some synchronous sites there where they've done that to fill that in. I don't really know exactly where that's gone, because I think there was always a question as far as, I'm not sure what kind of protection and stuff would be allowed to some of that stuff there. So I know that there's been stuff done on that. And, you know, there was also talk years ago about maybe, you know, using, you know, individual transmitters and, you know, to feed some of the elements of an array there. But some of the arrays get to be difficult, especially when you have, you know, very tight patterns there and achieving some of that with individual sources. But there may be a case down the road that when, you know, when some of this stuff, and even if some of that stuff could be more computer controlled to adjust, that people, that you could actually program something to feed these elements down the road. I think by the nature of the antenna impedances, you would always need some of our filtering, no matter how you fed some of that stuff. But probably from a source standpoint there, it probably wouldn't make a difference if we had, say, one transmitter feeding out to the three transmission lines or individual ones. Some of the filtering stuff that you would need that would be right at the tower base there would probably be the same no matter how you fed it, at least that way. So, any other questions? Thank you very much.